Welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me in the studio, somewhat wandering, is Phil Conlon. How are you doing there, Phil?
Oh, I'm rooted now. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Good. Yes. Today, we're going to be talking to our old friend, Zafar Bengash, and he is back from traveling in that troubled region of the Turkey, Iran, Syria, etc., and we're going to find out what the news is on in all these crisis spots, Syria and Libya, etc. Phil is going to be reading an item from Mr. Greenfield. Is his name?
Greenwald.
Greenwald.
Glenn Greenwald from Salon Magazine.
Yeah, he's really a sharp guy.
Yes, he surely is.
And also, we're going to have some news about Rwanda a little bit. I want to make sure that, just to tell you, to be interspersed, we'll have some information about Rwanda. There are refugees, Rwandan refugees, in Zambia. And this month, December, at the end of this month, the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees is planning to invoke a cessation on the refugees and encourage them to return to Rwanda. Not a very happy story. It's really a troubling one, actually. We're going to talk about that a little later on. I think we are joined now by Anne Garrison, and I should say she's AnnieGarrison.com. Are you there?
That's right. Yeah, it's actually AnnieGarrison.com.
It's like in Annie Get Your Gun.
No, my YouTube channel is actually Annie Get Your Gang. That was a little joke, but I started using my more sober byline, Ann Garrison, A-N-N-O-E, and my website is A-N-N-G-A-R-R-I-S-O-N.com.
Okay, great. And today you've got a story about developments in the Congo. We had a big demonstration here in Toronto. The main boulevard was blocked last week, and so we would like to know what's the story, and of course people can go to that, to your AnnieGarrison.com, but can you tell us what are you reporting on? This
is an extreme situation. It's a cliffhanger. There's fear that it's going to get really ugly, but something here is going to have to give. The Congo's not going to be able to continue as it was. Mm-hmm. After an obviously unfair, fraudulent, and violent election, the National Electoral Commission, which was stacked with supporters of incumbent President Joseph Kabila, announced on Friday that Kabila was the winner with 49% of the vote. Mm-hmm. They said that Etienne Tshisekedi, who was the leading challenger, had won 32%. Mm-hmm. Tshisekedi immediately came out and said he rejected the results and declared that he now considers himself the president of the DRC. Mm-hmm. The other leading candidate, the other leading challenger, agreed with him that he is now the president of the DRC.
Uh-huh.
No foreign head of state, no international agencies, the UN or the like, that I know of, have yet recognized either of them. Mm-hmm. Kabila's term ran out last Tuesday, but they did swear him in on Friday after they announced this result.
Uh-huh.
The Guardian on Saturday reported tear gas, breaking up demonstrations, burning tires, a big government security operation putting the Tshisekedi stronghold in Kinshasa under lockdown. That's the capital and the largest city of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times reported that there were police officers cruising around firing in the air to disperse crowds. And the Associated Press reported that police were rounding up young men in Kinshasa's opposition neighborhood.
So that's... what about states in the area? Are they saying anything? I mean, this is a very troubled region. We have Uganda, Rwanda watching, no doubt Angola and others. Is there any support there? Or what's... Do we know what they're saying or thinking?
I'll tell you what I know, and there's considerable concern about this. Neither Uganda, Rwanda, South Africa, Brazil, nor China have raised any objection to the election or suggested that they will have any problem acknowledging Kabila, though they haven't done so yet. There have been some very angry demonstrations in South Africa that met some violence from the police, tear gas, flashbang grenades, and people being dragged off and arrested. And Maurice Kearney, whom I talked to for KBFA and Afrobeat Radio, he's the executive director of Friends of the Congo, said that just before the election, Jacob Zuma, the president of the ANC, struck a deal with Joseph Kabila, the then incumbent president of Congo, to transport the electricity from the expansion of Grand Inga Dam at the mouth of the Congo River to South Africa, instead of giving it to selling it to BHP Billiton, a mining firm, the biggest mining corporation in the world, that wanted to use it to power an aluminum smelter in Kinshasa. Mm-hmm. So the Congolese in South Africa were really angry that Jacob Zuma was collaborating in this. China obviously has interest in Congo. All of these countries, China, Brazil, Uganda, Rwanda, South Africa, have interest in Congo, and they're not expressing any objection to this. But I don't think they have acknowledged Kabila's victory yet. And one of the indicators that this is really a crisis is that the International Crisis Group, which is a collection of international capital managers and former heads of state, generals, top UN officials, Louise Arbour, who was head of the International Criminal Court, and they have said that this election has no legitimacy, and that the UN donors and regional leaders, obviously including Zuma, Kagame, and Museveni, must avoid statements that could legitimize a badly flawed vote and destroy what is left of their credibility in the Congo. No leader, they said, should be congratulated until all disputes are resolved.
Well, that I think in about 1 week we're going to have to talk to you again, because this like sounds like a story that's about to happen more than one that did, huh?
Yeah, well, and let me say, I think if anybody wants to stand with the Congolese, and this is just my best guess, encourage the Canadian government not to acknowledge Joseph Kabila.
Well, of course, they're going to have to ask Washington about that. But
yes, of course they are. But, you know, Obama and Washington don't have quite as much power in this situation as I sometimes imagine, because clearly, the Congolese people, by absolutely refusing to accept this, have made the world pay attention.
Well, it's very interesting. Mr. Tshisekedi has come to the fore once again. He's late in life, but he has been sitting there as a powerful political element throughout the Mobutu years and throughout the Kabila years, and he never had any use for any of them, actually, is my memory. And everybody knew he was a very electable man. It's a heck of a story, actually. And, of course, Congo is the prize.
Is the prize, yes.
Yeah. Everyone has wanted this. And Kabila's, what an amazing story of Kabila the senior, who used to be with Museveni and Kagame. And then Kabila Jr. is not so stable. But so it's a formula for a heck of a fight in the Congo.
People were apparently following Tshisekedi to the rallies, and they were shouting, "Send him back to Rwanda, Kabila." And when there were some of Kabila's presidential security guard going after the crowds after the results were announced, they were turning around and shouting, "They're Rwandese." Yeah. And whether... Well, nobody I know seems to have much doubt about that with regard to the security guard. I don't know of anyone who has conclusive proof about Kabila being Rwandese, but the fact that this many Congolese people believe he is, and the reason they think so, is obviously significant. Mm-hmm. Oh, and one more thing about Tshisekedi. I know you have a full show planned here, but I wanted to say I don't know a lot about Tshisekedi. The one thing that seems clear is that he's the popular choice, and in this perilous situation, he did urge everyone to remain calm and plan nonviolent protests.
That's his profile. It's really important that you're following it. People to get this story, it's anngarrison.com. It's also, I guess, Afrobeat Radio and
Afrobeat Radio and sfbayview.com.
Well, and we really appreciate it. Thank you very much for the time. I hope people go to that, and we are going to have to follow this closely because I think we're coming, as we say, to the big prize, Congo.
Okay. I will tune out and listen to the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ann Garrison, who has been really following very closely the events right in the, literally the heart of Africa. And it is not the heart of darkness. We live in the heart of darkness right here.
Well, and she lives in a place that is about to see some real light. The Occupy movement in Berkeley, California, and across the West Coast is going to have a very interesting action this week on Wednesday. They're going to occupy the ports in support of a longshoreman strike lockout in Washington State that's been going on for some time. And the Longshoremen's Union is quite happy to work with the Occupy movement, and the plan is to shut down all West Coast ports in a demonstration of labor power against the behavior of the monopolists who control the ports and the way that they've been union bashing on the West Coast. So rather exciting development, and I'm always happy to see it come out of Oakland and Berkeley and places like that. Somehow that seems to breed just the best of American politics.
West Coast, you know? Yeah. I guess maybe the left coast gets it.
Yeah.
And they do have a tremendous history there. Again, we thank Ann Garrison for that update on the information there. With Shisekedi's a heck of a story, and we will talk more about him. I used to work at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and his name came up a lot. Though the Western media did not tend to talk about him. I'll remind you, we're going to be talking to Zafar Benkash and at the half-hour point. And there's a before Phil has something really important here we want to read. But I want to just say that a listener, actually once again on the left coast, the West Coast, was kind enough to send me a link to a site which I really highly recommend. It's exciting kind of thing to contemplate. It's called thehumanitarianwar.com. Go to that, humanitarianwar.com. A brilliant job is done of exposing the role of the so-called human rights, the International Criminal Tribunal, the permanent one in The Hague, led by this character, Ocampo. They interview him, and they do an excellent job, and they have you can sit and watch. And Ocampo, it's not just Ocampo, pardon me, there's there's an organization called the FIDH, quite well known in Africa as an alleged human rights body and advocate, and it is nothing of the sort. And they interview the individual responsible for the FIDH report, which was used at the United Nations to provide an argument for NATO intervention. You could call it one of the great enabling documents. And they showed the gentleman whose name escapes me, but he's reading at the human rights body about his organization's findings. And then they follow that with an interview, and this is, again, the humanitarianwar.com. They follow it with an interview with him. And, by the way, I don't know why he ever agreed to give the interview, because he's kind of a Peter Lorre character. You've got to watch him. He is a collector's item, and he is so wormy. And so they say to him, well, you said that planes had been attacking Libyan civilians, and there are people who dispute that. What's your source? And he said, the prime minister. And they said, what prime minister? He said, well, the prime minister of the new government. The new government. So what? When he gave you that information, what was he? Well, he was a human right. You know, he was representing the Transition Council. Really? And is it true he's a member of your organization? Yes. he's a member of our organization. The transition guys in Benghazi were telling him, and then he told the United Nations, as calling it a UN report, a human rights report. That's FIDH. They played a big role, by the way, in Rwanda. The registrar of the UN tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, is a member of FIDH, and he used to monitor trials at the time of Habyarimana's presidency. He would monitor the trials and write negative reports so as to enable the removal of President Habyarimana. Anyway, we go on and on. Now, Phil Conlon's got a great item from Mr. Greenwald.
Yes, this is Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com. This is a wonderful commentator, and so we'll just read it. George Orwell on the evil Iranian menace. The U.S. has long had Iran virtually encircled as a result of the American occupation of Afghanistan on Iran's eastern border, its invasion of Iraq on its western border, its NATO ally Turkey hovering on Iran's northwestern border, some degree of military relationship with Turkmenistan on Iran's northeastern border, and multiple U.S. client states sitting right across the Persian Gulf. That is Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, where the massive U.S. Fifth Fleet is stationed. Additionally, some combination of the U.S. and Israel has bombarded Iran with multiple acts of war over the past year, including explosions on Iranian soil, the murder of numerous Iranian nuclear scientists, in which even one of their wives was shot, and sophisticated cyber attacks. Meanwhile, top American political officials from both parties are actively demanding that an Iranian revolutionary cult be removed from the list of terrorist organizations. And just coincidentally, all these politicians are on the cult's payroll. In the past decade, the U.S. and or Israel have invaded, air attacked, and or occupied Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Lebanon, Sudan, Syria, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, to say nothing of the creation of a worldwide torture regime, a system of black site prisons around the world to which people were disappeared, and a due process-free detention camp in the middle of the Caribbean Ocean where many people remain in cage for almost a full decade without charges. During this same time period, Iran has not invaded, occupied, or air-attacked anyone. Iran, to be sure, is domestically oppressive, but no more so, and in many cases less, than the multiple regimes funded, armed, and otherwise propped up by the U.S. during this period. These are just facts. But, despite all these facts, all serious people, and that's capitalized, in the U.S. know that Iran is the aggressor, the modern Nazis, a true menace, while the U.S. and Israel are its innocent, peace-loving victims. Today, Iran claims that it took down an American drone flying over its country, either by shooting it down or overtaking its control system. Iran has made similar claims before, but this time the U.S. admits it last week lost a drone flying over what it claims was western Afghanistan, not eastern Iran. Between the intense wall of secrecy behind which the U.S. government operates and the less than reliable nature of the pronouncements from both governments, we'll likely never know what happened for sure. In any event, this is yet another case of increased tension between the two nations, and it's thus time for another round of those evil, provocative, aggressive Iranians, because, of course, no peace-loving nation, such as the U.S., would ever dare shoot down an Iranian drone if it flew over American soil.
In fact,
just imagine the massive retaliatory response that would be triggered if Iran were found to be flying drones over American soil, let alone simultaneously killing U.S. scientists, causing explosions on U.S. soil, backing U.S. terrorist groups, and launching cyber attacks on U.S. nuclear facilities, all the while occupying Canada and Mexico with more than 150,000 troops. In light of these belligerent U.S. actions and threats, along with seeing how the U.S. treats countries without a nuclear capability versus those who have one, nothing is more rational than Iran's wanting a nuclear weapon. Given the extensive violence and aggression the U.S. has perpetrated and continues to perpetrate on numerous countries in that region, one might think that not even our political culture could sustain the propagandistic myth that it is Iran that is the aggressor state and the U.S. that is its peace-loving victim. But of course, one who thought that would be completely wrong. Not only is it a widespread belief, but it's virtually mandated orthodoxy. But none of that should be at all surprising or confusing, given that 66 years ago, George Orwell, in his 1945 Notes on Nationalism, explained exactly the warped form of thinking that creates this mindset, and this is a quote. All nationalists have the power of not seeing resemblance between similar sets of facts. a British Tory will defend self-determination in Europe and oppose it in India with no feeling of inconsistency. Actions are held to be good or bad, not on their own merits, but according to who does them. And there is almost no kind of outrage, torture, the use of hostages, forced labor, mass deportations, imprisonment without trial, forgery, assassination, the bombing of civilians, which does not change its moral color when it is committed by our side. The nationalist not only does not disapprove of atrocities committed by his own side, but he has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them, unquote. I've cited this passage before, this is back to Greenwald, but it really does explain so very much, and that form of thinking extends beyond nationalism to all tribal loyalties. It's how a country that has repeatedly invaded, occupied, bombed, and killed civilians in numerous other nations over the last decade can look at a country that has done little or none of that, but has been practically surrounded by all that aggression, and be convinced they are the evil aggressors and must be stopped at all costs. One other point. Whenever you dare to suggest a comparison between the United States of America and whatever country happens to be the new Hitlers of the moment, you get accused of moral relativism. That has always struck me as so bizarre, because moral relativism actually refers to precisely what Orwell described. Actions are held to be good or bad, not on their own merits, but according to who does them. And there is almost no kind of outrage, torture, the use of hostages, forced labor, mass deportations, imprisonment without trial, forgery, assassination, the bombing of civilians, which does not change its moral color when it is committed by our side. As Rudy Giuliani said when asked if waterboarding is torture, quote, "it depends on who does it," unquote. Now that is moral relativism. And that is Glenn Greenwald, www.salon.com, and I urge people to read his commentary. It's delightful, and it's a guy who just cuts to the chase.
Yeah. No, he's a very sharp guy, a former lawyer, and a very brave individual, by the way. As the proverb says, if you're going to tell the truth, you better have one foot in the stirrup. And he's been in the habit of telling the truth. Greenwald, well, that was from Salon, right? But I guess you could probably just go.
That's right. Just actually, if you Google him, and it'll lead you to Salon.com, an interesting magazine with an independent perspective. And Greenwald, by the way, I mean, gave up a career. I mean, he was really on the make. You know, he was a good he was a lawyer and stuff like that. And he just looked at it one day and said, "You know, this is nonsense."
Yeah, I think he's found the operating word, which is hypocrisy.
Yes.
He says whenever a powerful figure in the United States, was making a pronouncement with Hillary, say, or Susan Rice, or the president, he says they're hypocrites. I don't know. You want to look. What would they do, as he pointed out, if an Iranian drone were flying over
you? Single Iranian drone.
Or, by the way, suppose that it was an Iranian drone that was looking at Canada, which, of course, is a harmless country, but it strayed into U.S. airspace. I mean, that would be... It's called an act of war. But empires think like that. When the American Civil War began, a British ship picked up a couple of Confederate big shots who were going to be taken to represent the Confederacy in London, where they were welcome, by the way. And a U.S. ship took it upon itself to intercept them and capture them as rebels against the U.S. government. Britain threatened war. They said, "Oh, no, you can't do that." I mean, and the London Times said, "We have to have a war. We can't." They took two U.S. citizens off a British ship, and that's no, no, no. So now it's America's turn. Once you become an empire, you lose your mind. And you certainly lose your conscience, because this whole idea is that, of course, you get to determine what goes on in Iran or Congo. It's ultimately your responsibility. Or as Obama told recently, and he was visiting Australia or something, he said, we're in the Pacific to stay. I don't know. What does that mean? You can, of course, sail your ships, but you don't own the Pacific. where you are would be as someone, authority on international law once explained on this program, that's all done with treaties, mutual respect among states. You say, we would like to go here. What do you think? It's worked out between equals. But if you have an empire, there's only the empire. There are no equals. And we have a system where the U.S. feels it has to remind everybody over and over that it's the boss, and moving to what Glenn Ford on our program called hard power. You don't see a lot of soft power. Now it's hard power. Everything has to be sold with a pistol, or, you know, the equivalent, which is an aircraft carrier. I just want to remind you again that this is very important news, I believe, that the government of Zambia, by the way, has just had a recent, there's been an election, and the outgoing government made a sort of one of those 11th-hour decisions to act on a recommendation from the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. There was a meeting in Geneva at which they brought up this deadly word cessation, where that is you lose, the UNHCR says, we think there should be an end of this status. And, of course, they surround it with, well, we don't want to see anybody forced back, and we would like to see maybe something worked out with the refugees. But they load the chamber, as they say, and they say, of course, but we want to see an end to this status of refugees. Now, there's about 4,000 Rwandan refugees officially. That would mean there's probably 8,000, 10,000 refugees in Zambia. The new government, which is saddled with... the new government is saddled with a problem of whether they want to act on the previous government's decision. The part that our listeners should pay attention to is that this is not a long-term matter. This is December. At the end of this month, they've basically said they're going to work with Rwanda to basically coerce these 4,000 to 10,000 people back to Rwanda at a time when political oppositionists are shot dead in Rwanda, have their heads chopped off, just to sort of add a little flavor, or shot dead while being refugees themselves in neighboring countries like Uganda or South Africa, assassination attempts.
Or Belgium, right?
Yeah, or
Belgium.
Been
assassinated in Belgium.
Yes, we've had some... Yeah, these guys have reach. Clearly, and they have a president who gets elected with 99%, which would Orwell would be very impressed. Therefore, it is a curious situation. By the way, there's only one government in Africa at the moment considering this, and this is the government of Zambia. So everyone should pay attention. The Right Reverend John Osmers of the Seminary of St. John, the Evangelist, Anglican Province of Central Africa, has issued a statement basically raising the alarm that something bad could happen here, and he's asking that people, that all of us take steps. I'm reminded of a Bertolt Brecht poem, a very short one. When he was on the run from the Nazis, he was sitting in a cafe, and he wrote a very short, smart line. And the line was, "That man crossing the street, does he have a friend somewhere who needs him? And our Rwandan refugee friends need us." We're going to take a short break, and we will probably be coming back talking to Zafar Benguys. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Check us out on the web, taylor-report.com. We were speaking earlier with Ann Garrison. Do go and check AnnGarrison.com to get the story on Mr. Tshisekedi and the Congolese election. I'm going to say it over and over. What I learned in working on the Rwanda issue is that what was really behind everything was the Congo. That's where everybody was headed. That's why the Ugandan and Rwandan armies found themselves all the way once to the outskirts of Kinshasa. What am I saying, outskirts? First time they took it was Mr. Kabila Sr., and I want to say again, our listener was kind enough to tell us about the humanitarianwar.com, which is a great documentary on the role played by so-called human rights organizations who prim themselves that they're superior to the rest of us in detecting human rights and fighting for them. And they were enablers of the blasting of Libya by NATO. And so the humanitarianwar.com, go there and you'll get a treat, and you're going to get to see a villain pretending he's a human rights big shot, who, again, I'm going to tell you, he reminds me of Peter Lorre. If you don't know who he is, I recommend you go and find out. Anyway, we are joined, I believe, by Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Hi. So you're back in the country. We're sure glad because, as you know, the regions that you write about and know about are just turbulent,
yes,
to put it mildly.
Exactly.
And I guess we have so many threats of war, and we just now mentioned that Glenn Ford on this program, he says, you know, America seems to be now a hard power country. They don't really spend a lot of time on diplomacy.
Right.
And it's causing, it seems that pressure to bring hard power to bear seems to be involved greatly in the crises that we see in Syria and there along their border with Turkey, and then, of course, Pakistan, where you are the absolute authority. They use force. If I could just start with the issue that we're learning about so much in on mass media, it was the confrontation seems to be approaching with Syria. A factor in it is Turkey.
Yes.
And I had Mr. Zimroya the name escapes me. Oh, Global Research, pardon me.
Yes.
And talking about this. And Mr. Rozov, who also writes for the Global Research. And the word, I couldn't find a better expression than Turkey seems to have a personality disorder. A year ago, they were the champion Muslim democratic force in the region, and they were talking about how they were going to really have a showdown with Israel over the treatment of Palestinians.
Yes.
And they were backing the flotillas.
Yes.
Now they're saying that Syria is a Turkish domestic issue.
Well, yes, exactly.
What is this?
That is the incredible kind of a situation that has emerged. First, with respect to Turkey's position regarding the flotilla and its argument with Israel, it's important to keep in mind that Turkey has been very careful in confining its disagreement, shall we say, with Israel only to the extent that it says that Israel should apologize for attacking the flotilla. Mm-hmm. Turkey has not called upon Israel to stop oppressing the Palestinian people. So, in fact, Turkey has played very cleverly on the sentiments of the Muslim people around the world, as well as other people who believe in fairness and justice for the Palestinian people, that it has framed the whole argument in such a way that it is presented as some kind of a confrontation with Israel, whereas in fact its focus is very narrow. So it has basically got what one would say as the best of both the world, mm-hmm. that it has garnered support and sympathy from people that empathize with the plight of the Palestinian people, and at the same time has not set such conditions that Israel would find difficult to fulfill. And I believe that Turkey and Israel would resume their normal relations if they have not done so already. I think they are doing it already in terms of sort of doing it quietly, mm-hmm. But they would they will resume their normal activities fairly quickly. With respect to the Syrian situation, that really exposes the contradictions in Turkish policy. You see, since the current party, the Development and Justice Party, came to power in October of 2002, their guiding principle, articulated by the current foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, it was that Turkey should have zero problem policy with its neighbors. Mm-hmm. Last year, they made much fanfare about this, that they were going to remove visa restrictions for their neighbors that included Iran, Syria, including, incidentally, Armenia, etc., mm-hmm. which was obviously welcomed by a lot of people, that this is now a new policy.
Well, it sounds like a very rational policy.
Exactly. And yet, as you pointed out, now Turkey has become so heavily involved in Syria that it now pro claims that Syria is its internal matter. So this whole policy of zero problem has been turned on its head, and there is hardly any neighbor of Turkey with which it doesn't have a problem, whether it's Lebanon, Iran, Syria. So you say, well, wait a minute, what has happened to Turkey? Let me tell you exactly what really has happened. You see, earlier this year, the Turks made a big blunder in assuming that the Syrian regime would collapse pretty quickly. They thought that the regime did not have internal support, that the establishment and the security forces would crack up, there would be massive defection, and that Turkey would have already positioned itself as a champion of the rights of the Syrian people. But nothing of this happened. The Syrian regime is not in danger of collapsing. The establishment in Syria, that includes the political elite as well as the business elite, are solidly with the government. So are the security forces. Minus these minor defections that they keep on presenting.
They all seem rather shallow, don't they?
Exactly. But there's another reason for it, and we'll talk about that as to why they are drumming up this allegation that there are mass defections, etc. But with respect to the actual situation on the ground, the regime still enjoys considerable support. I mean, you know, it is evident from the fact that the protests, etc., are confined to two cities, Homs and Hama, that are in the north, and it is evident that a lot of support, military as well as other kind of infiltration, is taking place from Jordan and Israel, and it has been going on for a considerable period of time. And from Jordan, of course, it is financed by the Saudis, the perpetual perennial troublemakers of the region, the most archaic and, you know, medieval, backward-minded people.
When they're not the vanguard of democratic revolution in the Middle East.
Exactly. And yet, it's incredible that the Saudis are calling for reforms in Syria, but they crack down so violently on people calling for reform in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, this is the incredible thing. For instance, you know, the king announced a few months ago that women would be entitled to vote in local elections, that is municipal elections, not this year, in 5 years' time. Okay, so that means that they didn't have any rights, but in 5 years' time, we said, oh, we are making progress. And the interior minister, who is now the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, he said, no, this is going to lead to problems. We don't want these women to have any such rights, and they shouldn't be allowed to drive. So this is the kind of regime that we are dealing with.
And Washington, by the way, calls this incremental progress.
Yes,
they're encouraged.
That's right, and they call it their closest ally. So, you know, they this is the kind of regime that is calling for reforms in Syria, but not in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Now, let's stick with the Turkish thing.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the mistake that the Turkish government made was that they assumed that the Syrian government was going to collapse quickly. It hasn't happened, and now they find themselves in a bind that the regime survives, and of course Turkey has found itself on the wrong side, and so it is becoming more and more irrational in its approach to this whole issue.
My personality disorder factor.
Absolutely. That's what it is.
By the way, let me tell the listeners, this is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net, where you get all the best analysis, crescent-online.net, and it's Zafar Bengash. We are talking about Turkey. And I guess I should ask you, what about opposition? By now, there must be a number of Turks here who have noticed that this government is not what they thought it was going to be.
Yes, exactly. In fact, there are a number of very important voices that are being raised in Turkey, and they're asking as to why Turkey has embarked on this policy when, in fact, this is an untenable policy. And so, they have challenged the government and said that the government is definitely not doing the right thing. It is going about it the wrong way, and that it ought to be it ought to take measures to rectify this policy that it has embarked upon. This has been written about in a number of Turkish newspapers, and some of the leading columnists have written about it, asking the government to reconsider their policy vis-a-vis Syria, because they see that this is going to be a great setback for Turkey. You see, we need to look at Turkey's situation in the context of its economic policy. When the current party came to power, they, of course, opened up trade opportunities, and as a consequence, when they first came to power, when Turkish exports were about $33 billion a year, now they have increased to $130 billion a year. And there's a lot of investment that has flown in. There is also a lot of Turkish investment in other countries, including in Libya and Syria, etc. In Libya, of course, Turkish companies had invested or signed contracts worth something like $10 billion with the Gaddafi regime. Mm-hmm. And yet we see that, you know, the same Turkish government that turned against Gaddafi, and obviously while those contracts had to be rescinded, it hopes that because it supported the opposition groups in Libya, that Turkey would be able to sign other lucrative deals with the new dispensation in Libya. But I'm not quite sure mm-hmm. whether that would occur, because obviously Britain and France and the U.S. and Italy, etc., did not attack Libya so that they could make it more amenable to Turkish contracts. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're going to, you know, take the lion's share of the deals, and Turkey would probably be left on the sidelines. In Syria also, Turkey has lost tremendously, because there were good investment opportunities, because Syria had opened up its economy. And again, Turkey finds itself at a loss in that situation as well. And one of the most sort of really disturbing aspects of Turkish policy is that it has provided a base for these renegade Syrian troops that have mm-hmm. Defected. And yeah. So basically, regrettably, Turkey has become a base for operations against Syria. Now, this is obviously an open declaration of war.
Yes.
When we look at it, and Turkey is obviously getting into very uncharted waters with the manner in which it's conducting its policy vis-a-vis Syria.
Yeah. Now, and this is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net, and certainly an authority on all these matters. What about the NATO element here? When we think of Turkey, it seems to be it's always almost a middle power, and it seems to be a European wannabe.
Yes.
It's still at the door, holding its hat, waiting to see if they get to be European. And as I understand it, that's never going to happen.
Correct.
And they're a member of NATO. So, in a way, I mean, this NATO matter, NATO is clearly in a restless mood and feels like knocking people down. That makes Turkey almost like a dagger in the region, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You see, this is the thing. On the one hand, Turkey is a member of NATO, and NATO is quite happy to use Turkey for its NATO membership, and yet the same NATO members would not allow Turkey to become a member of the European Union. I mean, the unkindest cut is that Greece has been allowed to join the European Union, even Cyprus.
Well, they're Christians.
Exactly. That's the thing. And in fact, you know,
Heinrich Heine said, you want to be a European, you have to be a Christian.
That's right. And even the Pope has said that, you know, Turkey doesn't belong to Europe because it's not a Christian country. And so, you know, you have this situation whereby, you know, Turkey continues to knock on the European Union's door, and it is repeatedly rebuffed, and yet it continues to play as a sort of, you know, front for NATO in carrying out NATO's dirty work. And so this is the regrettable situation that Turkey finds itself in.
Yeah. Now, I think you've made a very interesting point here, by the way, that, and we will certainly note it, that Syria has been able so far and appears to be capable of going forward here, holding itself together. They haven't had the sort of Libya-like defections, and I think people have pointed out they didn't make the big commitment that Colonel Gaddafi did of saying, okay, I agree with you. What do you want me to do to be a member?
Right.
And then they hung him. Killed him. Syria didn't do that, so in a way they haven't got themselves compromised as much. Are you hearing these reports that there are Russian warships in the region, indicating that they might stand by their commitment that they're not going to allow another Libya, and also the Islamic Republic? The Western media has been hopefully writing, I should say, in a hopeful manner that Russia and the Islamic Republic would abandon Syria. Do you see any sign of that from those quarters?
No, not at all. In fact, Russia has, as you pointed out, sent its warships to the region. And in fact, there is a naval base that Russia uses in Syria. Secondly, Russia has also delivered military hardware to Syria as part of its obligation. And at the United Nations, both Russia and China had vetoed a resolution that would have imposed sanctions against Syria of a similar magnitude that were imposed on Libya, because both the Russians and the Chinese found that when they went along with that no-fly resolution of March 17th of this year, the resolution number 1973, that immediately the European countries and the United States went much beyond the articles of the resolution and what was permitted in it, and they actually used that as a pretext to launch a full-scale war on Libya. I mean, if it was a no-fly resolution, that means that
a total war, by the way. I mean,
exactly.
they didn't allow them any breathing space. They didn't say negotiate, nothing. When the Africans said negotiate, they said get out of the way. We're going to kill this man.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, the no-fly resolution simply said that the Libyan government shouldn't use its planes or helicopters to attack its own population. Well, they never did that. They were actually fighting an armed insurrection. But even so, the Libyan government said, okay, we accept this resolution.
Yes. They didn't fly when they were told not to fly.
That's it. They didn't fly anything. And yet NATO planes went and they bombed civilian areas, they bombed hospitals, they bombed farm compounds, they bombed factories, they bombed schools. They didn't leave anything. And in fact, they went around, in fact, destroying virtually all of the cities in Libya. So when Russia and China saw what Britain, France, Italy, and the U.S. And their allies have done in Libya, they were not going to fall for a similar trap vis-a-vis Syria. And also because since Russia has very deep and long-lasting agreements with Syria, that Russia was not going to go along with another resolution that would have provided a pretext to the U.S. and its allies to go on a bombing mission.
Yeah,
although I would also like to point out that unlike Libya, which in terms of its population, it's quite small, and of course the Libyan society was and still is fractured along tribal lines. There are no such fault lines in Syria. The Syrian society is largely intact, and much of the opposition that we see in Syria, and even within the opposition, it is badly fractured. You see, the opposition groups that sit outside, they have adopted the position that there should be absolutely no negotiations with the Syrian regime.
Yeah, and they've exposed themselves, haven't they? I mean,
exactly.
They gave an interview with one of the leaders to the Wall Street Journal, indicating he would call on NATO.
Exactly.
And he had previously said he'd never do that.
That's right. The groups that are sitting outside, they want a NATO intervention in Syria. But the groups that are inside the country that do not want NATO intervention in Syria. So you can see that there is division within these groups as well.
Yeah. Those who might be killed.
Yeah, exactly.
Their minds are a little clearer.
That's correct, yes. Yeah. And they have, in fact, even called for serious negotiations with the regime, which is something that the outsiders don't want. The groups that are sitting outside, because they feel that if negotiations were held, obviously the groups that are sitting inside would be at an advantage because they are the ones that are going to negotiate with the regime. The groups that are sitting outside are not interested in negotiations because they don't want to go back and you know, they fear that they might be arrested.
Indeed. Well, of course, but also those inside understand that if NATO gets involved, they will be sidelined because it's going to be NATO's going to do all the talking.
Exactly. That is, yeah. They understand that, you know, and they can see the example in Libya as to what NATO did over there and how NATO is now dictating policy. So they clearly understand the situation and they don't want mm-hmm. to become a part of that.
Yeah.
But then you have this, you know, other tragedy with respect to Turkey hosting these renegade military
soldiers, which, as you say, that's a basis for war. If a state, you cannot have a soldier from a neighboring state running around saying he's going to attack.
Yeah,
you can't do it. Not according to law.
This
is Zafar Benkash, and it is crescent-online.net where you should go for information on all of this, all these matters. And Zafar, our media is playing a dangerous role, and I want to ask you about there's a kind of conceit that seems to function here. One of the ways they do the Syria story is to report everything said by anybody who reaches them on a mobile phone and say, well, you know, our informants. Well, most of these people are involved with the opposition,
yes.
And they tell all kinds of hair-raising stories. But then our media here says, well, you see, we're not allowed in, so we can't get the truth to our... We have to go with these informants. But where is the evidence that they got into Libya, did they accurately report what was going on in Libya?
No, absolutely not. They were just constantly lying, and this is, again, regrettably...
The problem is that we're not allowed to inform you. Baloney.
Yes. Well, even when they just wouldn't tell the truth. I mean, you know, as you pointed out quite rightly, when they were in Libya, they were constantly sort of saying that, you know, it's Gaddafi's forces that are doing the killings, whereas in fact, it was the NATO bombings and the rebels that were doing mm-hmm. Most of the killings.
And they kept alive the lie about African mercenaries.
Exactly. When in fact these people,
even
are,
while they were there, they could go around. They were
yes.
impossible.
Exactly. These people, the people that they refer to as African mercenaries, are Libyans because Libya is a vast country, and people that live in the south of Libya are of much darker complexion. They are basically of sort of, you know, African tribal groups, but they are all Libyans. And
yes.
So they are constantly being referred to as African mercenaries. The question that one needs to ask is, or to ask these people, but Libya is a country located in Africa. It is not located on the Mars.
You
know? So, I mean, they should understand that. The whole country is located in Africa.
Yeah, by a map is what we should say
yeah,
to people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yes, this is Zafar Benkash, crescent-online.net. We're very glad to have him. And Zafar, there's been something problematic developed between the United States and Iran. There's not as though there wasn't already plenty, but we have to ask this. One of these very sophisticated new weapons, which the world doesn't seem to be yet quite talking enough about, the U.S. is using drones all over the place.
Yes.
And they're very proud of them.
Yes.
But now... one of their drones took off, and somebody took over the piloting, and he wasn't sitting in a in Las Vegas, as they usually are, and they landed it, apparently landed it. Now, that
correct.
Was the Islamic Republic.
That's correct.
Should we remind the listeners that Iran is a highly developed country?
Exactly. You see, the Americans kept on saying that we lost control of this place over eastern Afghanistan and that it has crashed. And then once Iran announced that they had brought down this plane, then the report said, well, Iran has shot down this plane. Then 2 days ago, Iran actually put the plane on display. It was shown on Iranian television.
An uncrashed
absolutely
aircraft.
Absolutely uncrashed. It was absolutely, you know, just straight off the parking lot. It looked beautiful.
Yes.
And that means that Iran was able to electronically take control of the plane, bring it down, make it land, and I think now they have got a treasure trove of information about this very secret technology that America has.
Well, it must amuse you, right? I mean, you notice the racism. They say, well, what if they give that to the Russians?
Yeah, exactly.
Or what if they give it? Well, it kind of looks like maybe they gave it to themselves, and they seem to know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Maybe Iranians also understand science. I mean, it is insulting, isn't it?
Of course, absolutely, absolutely.
But what about the drone phenomenon? You are originally from Pakistan. You know that situation. I mean,
yes.
These drones are a totally new factor.
Of course, they have been in Pakistan. The U.S. has been using drones to attack civilians, and they started in June of 2004. And each time that there were missiles, Hellfire missiles fired from these drones, the Americans would allege that, well, we hit suspected militants. They never ever said that they've never ever even claimed that they were able to kill any militants. Anytime they killed people, they said these were suspected militants.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you
suspected.
That's
yeah.
Right. Anytime you suspect somebody of being a militant, then that's, as far as they are concerned, legitimate target. Now, so far,
the madness of empire is amazing.
So far, they have killed more than 3,000 Pakistani civilians as a consequence of these drone attacks alone. They started from June 30th, 2004 until the present time. And in fact, there was one particularly gruesome episode on October 23rd, 2006, when a drone missile was fired at a school in the mountainous region of northwest Pakistan. And the Americans said, oh, there were Taliban over there, etc. And it turned out that these were young children that go to school. I mean, obviously children, that's what they
yes.
do. They go to school. And the missile hit them when they were holding their morning assembly, and 80 children were blown to pieces and 200 or more were badly injured.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of...
A pilot in Las Vegas went to lunch.
Exactly, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kinds of things that they do with these drones, and regrettably, you know, causing thousands of innocent lives.
You know, Pakistan. I mean, by the way, these are all acts of war. Self-respecting countries do not tolerate it, but of course, they're dealing with a superpower that is, as a former senator from Alaska says, is intoxicated
yes.
and half mad. But how much longer can the Pakistanis tolerate it?
Well, I think they're but this thing is I suspect this thing is coming to an end, because you know on November 26th when the Americans attacked two border military posts inside Pakistani territory, killing 24 soldiers, that included an army major and a captain, as well as 28 other soldiers that were badly wounded. And that attack went on for 2 hours, despite the fact that the coordinates of these military posts were well known to the Americans, and the Pakistani military sort of liaison officers liaising with the Americans constantly told them that they should stop their attacks. They were targeting and hitting hitting Pakistani border posts, and yet those missiles kept on raining down on those posts for 2 hours. And so as a consequence, Pakistan has stopped U.S. Military convoy supplies to Afghanistan. They demanded that Americans shut down the Shamsi air base in Balochistan from where these drones were flown. That has been shut down and vacated. There is still, regrettably, the other military base at Jacobabad that the Americans are still using.
Yeah.
But I think the relations have definitely nosedived between Pakistan and the U.S. as a consequence.
Yeah. Well, that's a sobering note. This is Zafar Benghazi, crescent-online.net. We really appreciate it, Zafar. Thank you
very
much.
My pleasure, Phil. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. Check us out on the web, taylor-report.com, where you can hear this program and previous interviews. Thank Phil for reading that item from, is it Jeff? What's his first name?
Glenn Greenwald.
Brilliant
yes.
guy.
Yes.
And AnnGarrison.com. We really appreciate the information about the election in the Congo. And again, I want to remind you there is this great new documentary that it's called the Humanitarian War, I think it is. I suddenly lost my notes. At any rate, you can locate it, humanitarianwar.com. And I want to thank Alex very much. Everybody, have a good we're in a holiday period, but we will be back. So this is Phil Taylor with Taylor Report. We'll see you next week.